Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's great to be with you. We've got a busy Thursday today. We'll be talking about Hurricane Laura hitting landfall a little later in the show, as well as the protests in the sports world. But first, we look at an industry that's struggling mightily because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The restaurant industry is one of the largest in the United States. In 2018, the food services sector employed about 12 million workers. Then came the shutdown. So far, more than 2.5 million restaurant jobs have been lost since the pandemic began. One way some have tried to survive is by setting up outdoor dining and expanding delivery options, but even those measures have left many brick-and-mortar restaurants unable to pay for rent and supplies. And as the cold weather looms in some parts of the country, many are at risk for shutting down completely. Rachel Fine is the owner of Giggle Waters Restaurant and Movie Theater in Safety Harbor, Florida. And we've checked in with her a few times over the pandemic. Here's how she's adapting.
We launched a virtual food truck. And what I mean by this is we would go on site to any office, any hospital, any apartment complex with more than 25 people, and we'd set up shop and we would sell our food there. If you didn't want to come out to eat, we'll bring the food to you because I've got products and I need to move it. So we kind of brought the restaurant experience to anyone who would have us, and there was no delivery charges in that or anything. We just wanted to stay busy.
And you've been talking to us about this.
This is Garth in Brookline, Massachusetts. And I manage a restaurant which closed in March. Well, I wasn't officially let go till June. I've been looking for work ever since. Once the federal unemployment supplement went away, that coincided with the restaurant reopening without me. And I understand that I was an expensive employee, but that 1-2 punch has been really tough. Tougher on me than I even realized. Trying to figure out what's next.
Hi, my name is Gina. My fiance works in what you would consider a club venue, and they are still not opened, and he is no longer receiving the extra $600. So he's really harmed in two different ways, because as far as he's told, he's not going back until there is a cure or something better.
Lots of experiences there. Thanks for sharing your thoughts as always with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Amelia Lucas is a CNBC reporter covering restaurants, and she joins me now. Amelia, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Amelia, what's the state of the restaurant industry so many months into the economic downturn? Do we know how many have closed?
Yeah, so it's not entirely clear at this point, but Yelp data shows as of mid-July, there have been almost 16,000 permanent restaurant closures on their platform.
One of the biggest reasons for closures is what? Is it the fact that restaurants are unable to make up what they're losing as a result of not being able to have indoor dining?
Yeah, I would say that's probably the biggest factor right now. Landlords maybe not being able to work with them on finding a solution that works for both parties is also tough, you know, not knowing, you know, when you can finally pay your full rent. And a lot of restaurant owners are also deciding that they don't want to, you know, stack on more debt and have to deal with that down the line.
Do we know whether the closures are affecting smaller restaurants or larger chain restaurants? I know that larger chain casual dining restaurants had been already sort of in trouble before the pandemic. So who's being most affected here?
Right. I think across the line, we're seeing closures everywhere. You know, McDonald's, Dunkin' Donuts, they're all announcing closures. But definitely independent restaurants have been the hardest hit by this. They don't have as much access to capital. And it's been tougher for them to figure out, you know, their next steps and to pivot to takeout, delivery, outdoor dining.
And we talk about places like Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's. Those are largely franchise owned. Is that a reflection of the fact that the franchise owners are unable to keep up? Or, you know, wouldn't you expect that a corporation like McDonald's would maybe try to help its franchisees out in something like this?
Yeah. So all of the big fast food companies like McDonald's, like Dunkin', they have been working with their franchisees and giving them some help out there. But some of it is also, these might have been locations that were struggling before, and then the pandemic was just the last straw for it.
Amelia, you know, here in New York, and I'm sure in other places around the country, what we're seeing are a lot of restaurants, everyone from coffee shops to diners to more traditional restaurants, setting up outdoor dining venues as a way to try and stay afloat this summer. Some of them have also expanded to online delivery platforms, as you mentioned. But that just seems, you know, the fall is coming and outdoor dining just isn't feasible in the colder months of the year. How much of an effect, how many of these restaurants that are really holding on to outdoor dining do we expect will just not be able to make it to the end of the year?
Probably a pretty big amount, I would say. There aren't that many, you know, solid estimates out there, but definitely this is something that restaurant owners and the industry are really worried about. You know, you can't do that much with, you know, heaters outside, and it seems like in New York City, for example, Mayor de Blasio might just, you know, decide to stop outdoor dining when the cold weather starts hitting. So it's definitely a big concern.
And to that end, I mean, what are some of the folks who aren't familiar with how the restaurant industry works? I mean, the margins are pretty thin, aren't they?
Yes, the margins are very thin. And when you add in something like a delivery service, which, you know, not only do we as a customer have to pay a fee for our food, but restaurants also have to pay a fee to that delivery service, a certain percentage of the sale, you know, for going through that platform. So that reduces the margins even more.
We heard one of our callers at the top say that they had stopped receiving the $600 in unemployment benefits. I'm sure many folks are in the same position. But we also had something called the Paycheck Protection Program, which was an effort by Congress to save struggling businesses. Where does that stand? And what has it done for the restaurant industry?
Yeah, so the Paycheck Protection Program has definitely helped a lot of restaurants at this point. I think some restaurant owners are definitely hoping that there could be a second round of Paycheck Protection Program money coming, particularly with the outdoor dining issue and, you know, just a general slowdown expected for the fall and winter. There was a lot of confusion initially with the funding and, you know, loan forgiveness and who would qualify. And it seems like those problems were fixed later on, but definitely a lot of restaurant owners are still worried about having that extra debt on their balance sheet from taking those loans.
Now, of course, there are also restaurants that are open for indoor dining, depending on, at least here in New York, it really depends on which stage of reopening the region that you're in is in. We know out on Long Island, for example, that some places are open for indoor dining, but even there are restrictions, aren't there, Amelia? I mean, people can't just open restaurants and have full capacity, right?
Right. A lot of states, you know, input, you know, 25% capacity, 50% capacity, which again, you know, you're not going to be making as much money in order to pay your full rent. And then you also have additional social distancing rules. So, you know, maybe you could have 50% capacity, but because of those social distancing rules and keeping people 6 feet apart, you don't want to have more than, you know, 30% capacity.
And so even if a restaurant conceivably is allowing indoor dining, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be able to survive long term.
Right. There's still a lot of problems that come with indoor dining. And obviously with every restaurant, you know, there's a possibility of an outbreak that could cause them to, you know, close their doors for a week to clean and make sure that that doesn't happen again.
Yeah, there was a recent survey from Ernst & Young that found that 53%, that's 53% of consumers, would be uncomfortable eating inside a restaurant. You know, we just talked about the social distancing limitations for indoor dining. But let's say restrictions begin to lift across the board and we have, a much safer environment. It feels like the customers aren't going to want to return right away.
I think there will always be customers who will be willing to go inside those restaurants and eat no matter what. But it seems like the majority of people are still unsure, particularly in those regions like New York City, which was really hard hit by the pandemic.
You mentioned New York City. That's where we're sitting. But of course, this is a very big country. Restaurants across the country are being affected in different ways. Is there a geographic divide, Amelia, in how different restaurants are faring? Are restaurants perhaps in warmer climates able to stick it out a little longer than maybe those of us here up north?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that we've seen that big of a geographic divide in terms of success so far, but definitely in late May, early June, as some states, particularly in the South, were beginning to open indoor dining again. We definitely saw a faster recovery to those sales. And it seems like, you know, those are the places that are more likely to have people be comfortable sitting indoors and eating there.
Amelia, what are the limitations of delivery? Is this something that, you know, many New Yorkers, I think we have, all of us have a stack of menus, or we're you know, whip out our Seamless and just order, you know, with abandon. But as more restaurants try to make up the gap with delivery, really a feasible option, is that really going to help them close the gap?
It's hard to say. I think there's a lot of competition on, you know, platforms like Seamless, because there's so many different places you can order from. I think if you are, you know, if you've tackled, you know, how do you get your menu to travel safely and make sure that the food is just as good as if you were eating inside the restaurant, I think that definitely is one way that restaurants can help close that gap. And New York City and some other cities across the U.S. have input these caps on the fees that the platforms can charge. So that also is really helpful to those restaurants in making sure that those transactions are much more profitable for them.
Are we seeing any long-term trends based on your reporting in terms of how restaurants are trying to adapt, or things that we may have gotten used to that are never going to come back? I mean, will we see, you know, sort of packed bars and ever again in the near future? Or are there more restaurants that are just going to try and increase their presence on online platforms? Like, what trends are you seeing in the near future?
The digital trend is definitely not going away. It's really accelerated during the pandemic, and it might slow down compared to where it is now, but it's never going to go back to where it was before. Another thing that has completely disappeared, or will completely disappear, is going to be the buffet. Nobody's going to want to eat at one of those anymore. So many of them are closed now, and I think a lot of restaurants were struggling with them before the pandemic and making them profitable.
So watch out for online apps to see a surge.
Yes, definitely.
We're going to have to leave it there. Amelia Lucas is a CNBC reporter covering the restaurant industry. Amelia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Jennifer. We are in Kona on Hawaii Island. We own Shave Ice Ice Cream Shop, and we've been closed since late March. Every time we think we're going to reopen, there's a setback in the pandemic. A new stay-at-home order, the travel quarantine is extended, airlines aren't flying directly into Hawaii Island anymore. We have closed one location permanently now and hope that we have enough retirement savings to get us through to the end of the year or farther for the other location. Even when we do open, we'll be losing thousands of dollars every month until the travel industry recovers. We certainly won't be paying ourselves.
This is The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on any story or give us your thoughts on any topic. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think, and thanks for listening.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Hurricane Laura has hit the Gulf Coast. The hurricane made landfall last night in Louisiana and Texas, raising concerns for residents who remember the devastating effects of major storms like Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Harvey. So far, more than 500,000 people have been ordered to evacuate the region, but evacuations and setting up shelters have only been complicated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Chelsea Harvey is a climate science reporter for E&E News. Chelsea, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So Hurricane Laura started in the Gulf Coast and in the off of the Caribbean, and it suddenly became this massive storm. Why has it gained so much strength in these past few days?
Right. So Hurricane Laura underwent a process known as rapid intensification, which is when a hurricane dramatically strengthens over a 24-hour period. So on Tuesday morning, Laura was a Category 1. By Wednesday afternoon, it was already a Category 4, which was really a remarkable transformation. And there are a variety of factors that need to come together to sort of make that process possible. Warm waters tend to make it more favorable for a hurricane to spin up faster. There need to be certain favorable wind conditions, and everything sort of came together in the Gulf waters that sort of allowed this really rapid intensification of the hurricane over the course of just one day.
Chelsea, before the storm hit land, the National Weather Service had warned of an unsurvivable storm surge. That felt, and again, this is a word that we use very often these days, unprecedented. What does that mean, and how has that played out so far?
Yeah, it's interesting with hurricanes, you know, because we sort of rank them by category in terms of their wind speed. And I think a lot of people think that hurricane winds are the most dangerous part of the storm. And that's true. Winds do cause a lot of damage. But really, the biggest thing to watch out for is how those winds affect the waters at the coast. And so unsurvivable storm surge. We're already seeing this as the storm has hit the coast. The storm sort of it slams into the coast. It drives all of this ocean water very quickly onto the shore. As of the time that Hurricane Laura hit the Gulf Coast, the National Hurricane Center was projecting that the storm could actually drive ocean water as far as 30 miles inland, which is really remarkable. And that really just has to do with, you know, the size and the strength of the storm and the intensity with which it's able to push all that ocean water over the land.
Chelsea, how does this storm, you know, as it's hitting Louisiana and Texas, how does this storm compare to hurricanes like Katrina and Harvey?
Yeah, this storm is one of the biggest and the most intense storms to hit this part of the Gulf Coast in at least a decade. As far as its behavior, we're going to have to just kind of see how it plays out over the next day or so. Both Harvey and Katrina caused the majority of the damage that they wreaked on the Gulf Coast because of the flooding that they sparked, although that happened in different ways with both storms. So, you know, with Katrina, it was the failure of the levees and this huge storm surge that sort of washed over the area. With Harvey, it was a little bit different. That flooding was mainly caused by just the massive amounts of rainfall that storm produced. And Harvey was also interesting because it sort of hovered in place over the Texas coast for a long time, and it dumped all this rainfall and caused all of this river flooding on top of the storm surge. So with Laura, we're going to have to see how quickly it moves over the coastline, how much rain it dumps, you know, while it's there, and also the effect of the storm surge. So we'll just have to kind of see how it plays out over the next day to see how similar its behavior is to some of the recent storms that we've seen in the past.
Chelsea, you know, we before the pandemic, there was so much talk about climate change, and that has not changed in terms of how our climate is being affected despite the pandemic. So I'm wondering, does any of this have to do with, does the intensity of the storm, the fact that there were actually two storms, there was Hurricane Laura and then a tropical storm Marco that's now, that were sort of neck and neck. Does that have anything to do with the changing climate and the warming of the planet?
Yeah, that's a great question. This rapid intensification that Laura underwent is really interesting. And that's a process that scientists believe will probably happen more frequently in the future as the climate continues to warm. And that has a lot to do with warming ocean temperatures being more favorable for sort of rapid spin up of these hurricanes. And they turn into major hurricanes a lot faster. And so models project that rapid intensification process may happen more often as the climate changes. And just in general, you know, Laura hit the coast as a Category 4 storm. It's a major hurricane. And models do project that in general, hurricanes will be stronger in the future, and that a greater proportion of the hurricanes that do form are likely to be major storms of a Category 3 or higher. So I think the thing to really pay attention to in the future is how strong are the hurricanes that do form, and how many of them are going to be major hurricanes by the time they hit the coast.
Well, and there's also we need to talk about the fact that we are also in a pandemic, that folks are trying to evacuate. people have been ordered to evacuate the region. Nearly 500,000 people are trying to find places to go. But of course, this is complicated by the fact that we are trying to maintain social distancing and mask wearing and not spread the coronavirus. So how is that adding to the complications of evacuations right now?
Absolutely. No, it really is complicating the evacuation process. I mean, it's in the case of a storm like this, it's absolutely imperative that people along the Gulf Coast evacuate. But it's difficult because, you know, then people are faced with this choice where they might be exposed to the virus if they go, you know, to a shelter where they're staying with a lot of other people, or if they get on an evacuation bus with large groups of other evacuees. And so there are measures that have been taken to try to mitigate those risks, you know, requiring masks in shelters and on the buses and doing temperature checks before allowing people on the buses. But, you know, of course, there's always going to be some risk. And so it does make it a difficult choice for people who are trying to maintain social distancing, but also, you know, want to protect their families and do the right thing and get out.
Chelsea Harvey is the climate science reporter for E&E News. Chelsea, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's been 4 years since San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick first took a knee in response to police violence against Black people.
I mean, ultimately, it's to bring awareness and make people, you know, realize what's really going on in this country. There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for, and that's something that needs to change.
That message from 2016 resonated last night across the professional sports world when players from the NBA, WNBA, Major League Baseball, Major League Soccer, professional tennis, and more decided against playing games in response to the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Wisconsin. Stars including LeBron James, Naomi Osaka, Mookie Betts, Elizabeth Williams, and others released statements denouncing the shooting and talking about their decision not to take part in games. The reaction from players and broadcasters was swift.
The consensus is to not play in tonight's slate of games and to kneel, lock arms, and raise fists during the national anthem.
I always remember this day and I always remember this team just having my back.
We are calling for justice for Jacob Blake and demand the officers be held accountable.
Like, we got this little guy right here that we see every day. His life matters. He needs to know that he can do what he wants to do whenever he leaves his house.
As a Black man, as a former player, I think it's best for me to support the players and just not be here tonight.
And being a Black man in America, it's not easy, so.
We've seen this in all of our heroes constantly taken down. We understand it's not gonna end. But that does not mean, young men, that you don't do anything.
Amira Rose Davis is an assistant professor of history and African American studies at Penn State and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Amira, thanks for being with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Major, major change in the sports world last night. The WNBA actually took the lead on a lot of this activism. How do we explain what happened yesterday, Amira?
Yeah, like you said, the WNBA has been leading the way for years in terms of kneeling and holding pressers about police brutality. And really, we see this has been building, as you mentioned, it's the four-year anniversary yesterday of Colin Kaepernick's kneeling. But yesterday was essentially a strike across multiple platforms where something hit a tipping point. And we have seen since the murder of George Floyd and the molasses-like way Breonna Taylor's murder has been dealt with, that there has been a rise in athletic activism, a new wave that has been more acute, more poignant, and more decisive in action. And I think that's one of the things that we saw last night.
Many of these players, I mean, if there was an industry that was really trying to survive this coronavirus pandemic right now, sports tried to do everything it could in its power to make sure that their players from Major League Baseball to the NBA are playing games. These folks have been quarantined. Some of them have come down with the virus themselves. How do you explain what happened in that context? I mean, is it was part of the, do we think that part of what happened here was the fact that these players are in a bubble, that they're able to, you know, organize rather quickly because of the coronavirus?
Yeah, no, it's a great question because I think that the effects of the virus have actually amplified the possibility of collective action and solidarity, not just being in proximity together, but the time off from sports that we had in the spring let a lot of people communicate and talk and think through sporting structures and power dynamics. And I think that that has also amplified this current moment where leagues you've seen not only are trying to get people to return to sports and to get the games flowing again, but they also have had to deal with these kind of corporate expressions of Black Lives Matter, whether it's painting courts or putting jersey names on their jersey. And I think one of the things that we saw last night was players are essentially saying these performative actions were good, but they're not enough. And here we are in this moment, in this country, in a pandemic, in the midst of a revolution, and we can't act like business can go on as usual, and we can't be your entertainment to let you escape as viewers, as fans, because this has to stop.
Most notably, I think we're also seeing a couple of things. Broadcasters, including Kenny Smith, very emotional in talking about why he would not want to participate in his broadcast yesterday. White players supporting their Black colleagues as well. What do you make of all of that? The fact that this is really going beyond what Colin Kaepernick essentially started 4 years ago.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I think about a lot is that in the history of the country, Black people have been absolutely fine to be accepted as entertainers, whether it's athletes or singers, et cetera. And so racism has actually built the platform on which they now stand. And athletes harnessing that can act as both amplifiers and drivers of the conversation. And I think that this moment, we can't discount the activists on the ground, the boots on the ground that has, without that work, we wouldn't be here either. But one of the things that athletes are able to do with sports is take that platform that's been built, take that one area in which Black bodies have been accepted or had the ability to get a foot in the door, and say, we're going to use this platform, we're going to amplify these concerns, and we're going to drive the conversation because you're watching us. And even if you don't want to hear our voice, we have actual power. We have power in the labor that we do and what we provide, and we're going to harness that to make sure we're having a conversation that includes all of the inequities that we're talking about.
You know, I'm wondering if we know where the leagues stand on this. I mean, some of these players, I imagine, are breaking some sort of agreement or contract as they do this. Do they have the support of their teams and their leagues?
Yeah, I think it's something to keep an eye on. Certainly under their CBAs in both the NBA and the WNBA, there's no strike language around resistance like you saw. Now, oftentimes it's phrased around collective bargaining, right? And so holding out in terms of changing revenue streams within the leagues, but it also would cover this. So it will be something to watch because I think the leagues are going to have to contend with that they've been giving lip service for the last few months towards Black Lives Matter. And now it's like, all right, it's here. What does that support really look like? And I think that there's a lot of nervous executives. I think there's a lot of Slack messages and meetings happening about how do we do this? How do we contain it? And I think the way that power works in terms of sporting structures is that, you know, athletic labor is such a threat to that I think the calculation is how can we support this and how can we also rein it in or get it to a place that we can control it again? And so I think one of the things to keep an eye on is in what ways do the players keep driving the conversation, and in what ways does perhaps a production video or another kind of statement or a league donation become the kind of performative action in replace of tangible requests? And I think that is where we keep our eye on, because those next steps are going to be crucial in terms of the sustaining of this movement.
I mean, I can't, I'm watching this unfold and I can't stop thinking about Laura Ingraham's comments to LeBron James mm-hmm. to just shut up and dribble.
Yes.
And how far we have come from that moment. I mean, and when you think about that, what does this tell you in the arc of activism among professional sports?
Yeah, I mean, I return to those comments a lot, the shut up and dribble comments, because I think it underscores that idea. If you have like a racist reaction bingo card, one of the biggest things you'll see today still is a parroting of that. Like, you're so rich, you're here to entertain us. Like, that's all you're good for. And I think it really underscores that the kind of idea that, you know, you're privileged to be in this position. That's the only way, you know, you should just be grateful. You don't have a voice. You can't talk, except, of course, right, 2 weeks ago when a certain college athletes were saying they want to play, then all of a sudden it was like, you have to listen to players. And so you can see that it's really kind of weaponized in political and racially and racist ways. But I also think if you're looking at that grand arc, Dr. Harry Edwards would call this like the fourth wave when Colin knelt 4 years ago. And I think that we're in a new iteration of that, where there is more understanding of collective labor resistance. There's more understanding of solidarity. If you have one person, right, they get made rendered disposable very easily. Colin is blackballed, right? Craig Hodges before him. We have a long history of watching athletes become disposable when they're inconvenient. But you can't dispose so easily of an entire league. And so that solidarity aspect is really key. And that's one of the things that is new about this moment, is how collective this action has been.
When we think about the bigger picture here, mentioned earlier that this is happening in with the backdrop of the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, sports teams, professional sports have tried everything to get their teams back playing. I wonder, you know, if there's no season, if there are no fans, they're already losing ticket sales. You know, Major League Baseball has cardboard cutouts of folks in the stands. And there are no players. What does this do for sports at the bottom line, Amira?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think, like so many things, COVID has forced us to re-examine systems and the status quo. And, you know, so much of the reaction has been like, let's just get back to normalcy. But normalcy is gone. What professional sports look like going forward, I think, is going to shift because of multiple things. What happens when you don't have fans that you're, you know, trying to protect, and then therefore, you know, especially like the NFL, thinking about their fans as a shield for some of the disciplinary action they take against players who might want to be vocal? What happens when you remove fans from the equation? What happens when you realize that the athletes, right, the labor in this equation, are the most important part of your brand or your product? How does that shift what the power relationship, what the control looks like? I think on the other hand, it's opening up avenues for other ways of engaging with sports. So we've seen the WNBA, right, have a huge ratings increase because they're on more platforms, because they're partnering with Twitter and other media markets that perhaps are non-traditional versus like cable or something like that. And so I think that it's going to really change some of the complexities of professional sports moving forward. And we've seen athletes already start to articulate, you know, opting out, whether it's to focus on racial justice initiatives that they were already into, in the kind of model of Maya Moore, who, of course, stepped away from the game to help Jonathan Irons get out of prison, you know, a year ago, or many people who've said, no, I'm not playing during a pandemic. I can't risk my health like that. And so I think that it's a shock to the system that has said, you know, winning over everything, sports must go on, et cetera. And I think that we're in a moment where people are saying, well, does sports have to go on? Like, at what cost? Mm. And I think that it's very interesting to see what will be kind of rebuilt as we move through this moment.
Amira, we've got less than a minute to go, but I just wonder where we go from here. Is the NBA season over?
It's a great question. Again, very uncertain. We know that the Lakers and the Clippers have voted not to play. I think it has put it up in the air, and we all will have to wait and see.
Amira Rose Davis is Assistant Professor of History and African American Studies at Penn State and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Amira, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Jerry Seinfeld on making a life in comedy.
This is a writer's game. If you can write, you succeed. If you can't, you will not make it. Any comedian can be funny on stage, but the bullets are the writing.
Jerry Seinfeld on his film Unfrosted and more. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're back with The Takeaway. And while the world had its eyes on protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin over the shooting of Jacob Blake, dozens of protesters were arrested in Louisville, Kentucky after a massive demonstration demanding justice for Breonna Taylor. It's been more than 5 months since Louisville police officers fatally shot the 26-year-old EMT in her own home, and people nationwide are still calling for answers about Breonna Taylor's case in the streets and on social media. But some of the online and offline activism has translated into real-world policy changes in Louisville. Keturah Heron was behind some of that change. She's a policy strategist at the American Civil Liberties Union of Kentucky.
I think the biggest piece of policy that we have seen is the passing of Breonna's Law, which bans no-knock warrants here in Louisville, Kentucky. And it also requires police officers, when they do any type of warrant, that they have to have their body cameras on 5 minutes before they go and 5 minutes after the warrant is complete. We've also seen the Louisville Metro Council propose a couple other things. And so now police officers, after they are involved in a police shooting, whether it's a fatality shooting or not, anytime the weapon goes off, they have to do a drug and alcohol screening within 2 hours of that incident.
What was the process like to get Breonna's Law passed?
Myself and the team at ACLU and some other folks in the community started actually drafting a version to end no-knock warrants. And we were maybe 2 days into the draft, and we found out that Metro Council members were actually planning on filing something at the end of the week. And so after speaking to them, we actually just gave them our very, very rough draft. I mean, it was so rough that I only actually read through the whole thing once. And so we gave that to them. And once we gave it to them, they actually used a lot of our language in the first initial draft that was filed. And at the end of the day, the language that we originally put in there was a language that the community was fighting to take out. And so policy is very interesting and strange. I think that you had the pressure of the community. I think that leadership within Metro Council was trying to find an answer. They wanted to do something. And so I think that they definitely felt that pressure. I also think one thing that's interesting is when you called the Louisville Metro, when you called the mayor's office, when you called City Hall, as soon as you called, the phone rang once, and then a voice recording came and it said, if you were calling in regarding Breonna Taylor, press 1. For all other inquiries, press 2. And so I think that that just shows the power of what was happening in the city, and that Metro Council felt that pressure to pass it. And then I also think that some of the folks on Metro Council knew that this was a tactic that was outdated and dangerous.
Now, we're talking about Metro, but let's broaden this out to the Kentucky State Legislature. They're also considering a version of Breonna's Law, from what we understand. What's the likelihood that that will pass at the state level?
Representative Attica Scott has filed a version of Breonna's Law to end no-knock warrants, very similar to what was passed at Louisville Metro. She added the alcohol and drug piece to her bill after any type of police-involved shooting. I do think that we will see a version of Breonna's Law pass on the state. What the final version looks like, I'm not sure. And I've been very clear to folks, it's my job to make sure that we get the best version of Breonna's Law passed statewide.
Going back to the city for a second, you know, one of the things that is talked about a lot when it comes to police reform is also the ability to have a civilian complaint review board. Is that part of what you expect to see in terms of changes at the city level?
Yeah, so currently there is a civilian review work group, and we are in the process of creating legislation to decide what this board should look like, of what powers this board should have. Should they just be looking at LMPD or the police department, or are they going to be monitoring other things within the city? And who should be on that board? The thing and the issue is that it's been very clear from community and from folks on this board that we want to make sure that this group has subpoena powers. If the board that we create here locally in Louisville, if we want that to have subpoena powers, that is something that we would have to go to the state legislators for them to allow to happen. It would be something that would have to be legislated at the state level.
We've been talking on The Takeaway about Breonna Taylor's case and particularly the activism surrounding the case. And that's continued to grow exponentially. And we've seen everything from, and Keturah, I'm sure you've seen this, the cover of O Magazine, the cover of Vanity Fair, billboards that Oprah Winfrey's bought in the community, something called BreonnaCon. How do you feel about the sort of national attention that this case is getting? Is there the risk of sort of trivializing what's happening on the ground and some of the work that local activists are doing when it gets to this point?
I think that this is a very complicated question. And one thing that I just want to lift up is, if there was no national attention around Breonna Taylor, I'm not sure that we would be where we are today as far as having our eyes and fighting for justice for her. I think that what you see in jurisdictions and communities, that the local media and the city or the police department or the mayor's office, they do a great job of keeping stories under wraps. And I think that that's what we first saw in Breonna Taylor's case, is that many folks didn't even know that it happened. You heard that there was some type of incident happened, but you didn't know really what happened. And I think that when you get the national attention, you start to get more details. That pressure comes on from the city. The mayor has gotten more pressure. And so they didn't have to just answer to the people in Louisville, Kentucky. Now we're having to answer to the people across the state and then the people across the nation. And so I think it's one of those situations where it's a gift and a curse. If there's not national attention, do families start to receive justice? I think that when you see different pictures and posters, I believe that people, especially artists, they express themselves in different ways. And right now we are in a very traumatizing era around Breonna Taylor, around George Floyd, and then what we just saw a couple of days ago, Jacob Blake. And we have to allow people to express themselves. We have to know that people have the best intentions, and that if names like Breonna Taylor or names like Jacob Blake or George Floyd, if they weren't getting national attention, I don't know if we would be seeing justice for them.
Keturah Herron is a policy strategist at the American Civil Liberties Union of Kentucky. Keturah, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
I'm now joined by Paul Butler, Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University, a former prosecutor and the author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. We're going to be talking about how the uprisings for racial justice have translated into concrete national policies. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Tanzina. It's great to be here.
So let's start with the chokehold laws. Since the killing of Eric Garner by police here in New York in 2014, chokeholds have really been a big part of the conversation around police brutality. Where do many of the reforms stand right now?
On the state and city level, many jurisdictions have passed laws banning chokeholds, and others have gone even further and banned any kind of neck restraint or ear restraint. The whole world saw those very graphic pictures of police officers restraining George Floyd by the neck, by the back, by the arms. It's particularly dangerous when police officers put their hands on anybody's neck. A chokehold is a specific way of doing that, but there are other kinds of neck restraint devices. I'll tell you, Tanzina, when I look at police manuals that instruct officers how to do these kinds of holds, I wouldn't want a doctor or nurse doing this on me, much less a police officer who isn't a trained medical profession.
And yet, you know, while those policy changes are happening, there's some debate even here in New York City, Paul, about the specifics when it comes to this type of diagram compression. There's a debate here in New York as to whether or not some of the language in provisions that would ban chokeholds go far enough. And right now, there's a question about whether or not chokeholds should be made illegal only if they cause injury due to asphyxiation. Do you have any initial thoughts on that?
It's an uncomfortable reality that there's some police work that's just straight up violent. If the police believe reasonably that they face a deadly threat, they can take you out. And under the law, it doesn't matter how the police kill you if they have legal justification to do so. The same thing is true with other forms of violence. They have to be equivalent to the threat. But if someone is causing a non-deadly threat, the police can use non-deadly force in response.
Paul, let's talk about no-knock warrants, which we talked a lot about in when it comes to the case of Breonna Taylor. Breonna's law has been passed, at least in the, at the city level, but are we seeing efforts to change and curb no-knock warrants around the country?
We are. So part of this is constitutional, and that's good news for activists because that way you can get broad-based changes as opposed to having to go to the 18,000 different police departments in the United States and ask each chief if they can stop no-knock warrants. So a no-knock warrant is an exception to the general requirement under the Constitution that when the police are serving a search warrant, they're coming to your house to look for stuff, they have to knock on the door and they have to tell you that they're police officers. The Fourth Amendment demands that, according to the Supreme Court, but there are exceptions when knocking and announcing would put the police in jeopardy. A lot of people think that those exceptions have been way overused, but judges tend to be respectful, let's say, to police officers and grant these warrants, even in cases in which they're probably not necessary.
Paul, one of the things that we've heard throughout the summer is that many protesters in this uprising for racial justice have been calling to, quote, defund the police. Some people are straight abolitionists and say police departments should be completely disbanded. Others are saying that that translates into siphoning resources away from police towards other community-based programs. Where do those efforts stand, Paul?
So as you say, defund the police means different things to different people. To some folks, it's an understanding that the best first responders to every emergency aren't always people with guns. And so even President Trump, who hasn't been a leader on these issues, has an executive order which talks about the importance of co-first responders. So when someone calls 911, and it's a mental health crisis or an issue arising from homelessness or addiction, in addition to or instead of people with guns, mental health counselors, sometimes elders from the community are better at resolving beefs than cops. So even Trump's executive order recognizes the importance of those additional co-responders. Of course, a lot of people go further when they think about defund the police. They think about reallocating money that goes to policing to other kinds of community services, violence prevention, health care, things that advocates say make communities safer than having people with guns and the power to arrest show up often after harm has been done.
Paul, we'll be watching as this conversation continues. Are there any other efforts, at least nationally, when it comes to police reform that we should be paying attention to?
So many, Tanzina. So we can think about jurisdictions that are now requiring body cameras that didn't before. Lots of movement on the issue of transparency. So documenting hate crimes. In New York City, there's a new requirement that police disclose the various kinds of surveillance tactics that they use. Qualified immunity is something that a lot of people are talking about. Right now, the law is basically, you can't sue me, I'm a cop. And a lot of people think that makes police officers less accountable because they're not personally on the line. And so there are moves all over the country to try to limit this doctrine of qualified immunity.
So the protests are working.
According to the New York Times, this summer we've seen the largest social protest movement in the history of the United States. June 6, 2020, on that one day, almost 600,000 people protested in 550 places all over the country. According to estimates, overall, somewhere between 15 and 25 million people have taken part in these protests. And so the storied civil rights days from the 1960s, we can think about the March on Washington of 1963 that had probably about 250,000 people. About 70 to 80% of those were African American. Compare that to the number of protests now all over the country. Again, we're thinking in the millions and millions, not the hundreds of thousands. Anecdotally, many, if not most of the protesters have been white. And part of this is about the pandemic and people having more time to watch the news. If you saw that video of that cop putting his leg on the neck of George Floyd, if you weren't moved by that, you're not a human being. Thankfully, human beings saw that and they stepped up. And I think that's directly responsible for this rush of legislative activity we're seeing all over the country.
It's one of the most difficult things I've seen in quite some time. Paul, thank you so much, as always, for your insights. Paul Butler is the Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University. Thanks so much, Paul.
Always a pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for joining us. We have to give a shout out to the team that makes this show happen every week. Our board operators are Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. Line producing was Jose Olivares. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer, and her crew is Jackie Martin, Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Lydia McMullen-Laird, and Asher Stockler. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. David Gable is our executive assistant, and Lee Hill is our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. Amy Walter is with you Friday. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and I'll see you Monday. Thank you.